Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the Zero Point Radio Show through BBS Radio. I hope we don't have too much background noise today. I'm up on Parliament Hill in Ottawa. Right now, I'm looking at the Peace Tower, towering above me. Absolutely beautiful structure, which is where Canada's House of Parliament meets. And we've had a heavy, heavy chemtrail spraying day all over Ottawa today, taking lots of pictures of them as I'm trying to put together a documentary video called The Chemtrail Poisoning of the Citizens of Ottawa. But we're not going to talk about chemtrails today. I'm going to interview some people involved here on Parliament Hill, because I've been out today to support the Ottawa 9/11 Truth Group. And then we'll talk to several other activists. Okay, so I'm going to bring my co-host on, Jim Moffat from Toronto. Jim, how are you?
I'm okay. Are you shouting?
Yeah, am I too loud?
A little bit, yeah. I think you're coming through pretty clearly. Just talk normally. You don't have. Just say something.
Okay, I don't have to be up so close to the phone.
Yeah. That's perfect, actually. That's much better. At least that's the way I'm hearing it, so I assume that's how everybody's hearing it.
Okay, so I'm going to just wander around on the hill here and interview a few of the people involved. They put this event on in Ottawa for the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and they showed the Architects and Engineers new movie up on Parliament Hill, and we just had some audio presentations. And one of the gentlemen who spoke has attended the Toronto 9/11 Truth hearings this last week, and I'll let him introduce himself. He's an architect from Stratford, Ontario. Sorry, it was Mike Bondi or Mark?
It's Mike Bondi, that's right, yeah. And I'm an engineer from Stratford, Ontario.
Okay, thanks, Mike. Okay, so I'm going to just hand it over to Mike. And, Mike, if you feel comfortable, you can just tell us a little bit about how the conference went and what you thought were the highlights. And
Great. So thanks, Chris. So, yeah, the Toronto hearings.
I'll let you hold the phone.
Oh, you'll let me hold the phone.
Because that's probably easier.
So the Toronto hearings were 4 days of expert testimony from a variety of witnesses from around the world. And they talked about physical evidence. They talked about evidence of insider trading before 9/11. They talked about the hijackers. They talked about the psychology of 9/11, all different aspects. And we also heard from Cynthia McKinney and Senator Mike Gravel, and the initiative to start citizen investigations across the United States and various states. And so it was just an amazing 4-day event with just about everybody you could think of from the truth movement. And the point of it was that the evidence that was presented will be judged by a panel of distinguished experts. One of them was the honorary president of the Supreme Court of Italy, and there were three other distinguished panelists who are academics, and they will be producing a report called the Final Report on the Toronto Hearings, and it'll be edited by U.S. Attorney James Gurley.
And was there much discussion of what people thought we should do as next steps? You mentioned the citizens' committees for the investigation. I've heard briefly of this. Maybe you'd elaborate a little bit upon this. I think they not have 3 or 4 states where they've already tried to put it into the public forum or on the table, and they had to get signatures, do they, to support it? Can you explain a little bit about that effort?
Yeah, I think what I would do is point your listeners to go online and do a Google search for Mike Gravel. It's Senator Mike Gravel. He's a former senator, I think, from Alaska. And there are several states. Michigan, I know, is one of them. I'm not really sure which one's the other ones. Perhaps California, but depending on the laws in various states, this initiative can go forward in terms of a citizens' investigation. So you can find out more information. They have a website. Just do a search for Mike Gravel, citizen investigation into 9/11.
And you were saying also the conference was videotaped and it was broadcast, so people could actually view it online.
Yeah, Chris, that's right. We did broadcast it on a couple of different websites. Ustream was one of them, and there was another one as well where it was webcast live so that people could watch it online while it was going on. On the final 2 days of the hearings, we had over 9,000, almost 10,000 people on the 11th of September, on Sunday the 11th. So, yeah, quite a few people were able to, at some point in time, tune in and watch part of the hearings. Videos of every piece of testimony, every witness are going to be available. We're working on that right now to get the best video and sound quality that we can so that we can put that out and make it available to people.
And I understand you actually sold out tickets, eh? Because at one point I was hoping to come down, but I found out that you were sold out. So there were over 100 people in attendance.
Yeah, that's right. We the number of people that could attend actually was brought down and had to do with fire regulations, unfortunately. So I think they found 110 tickets, and they were $200 each for all 4 days. And yes, it was a packed crowd. It wasn't a big room, but it was very full and very well attended.
I think the most valuable thing is that it's all on video and now it's available for worldwide consumption. So in a way, even if it's a small crowd, that's a side issue almost. And you had a very distinguished group of people. Was Cynthia McKinney one of the people on the panel?
She wasn't on the panel, Chris, but she was an expert witness. So she actually did come and speak, and she to the panel. So, yeah, and it was, like again, it was quite a lineup of incredible people. You can go to torontohearings.org to get more information to see who spoke. And if you keep, you know, visiting in the next couple of weeks, we will start to link to the video so that you can watch the testimony online.
I'm interested, Mike, how did you first learn of 9/11 or have your first suspicions? I know when it happened on that day, I was working in a prison, and I watched it on the range with 24 men that I was working with. I'm a psychologist. But after, when it occurred, it's like, for me, I never gave it a second thought, really, until 5 years later when my youngest son showed me the movie Loose Change. And as soon as I saw that and saw how the towers came down, I realized it was an obvious hoax. I knew nothing more about it, and I still had many wrong ideas about it for years. You know, we're all learning. But I'm wondering, how did it come upon you? Were you a late waker-upper?
I wouldn't say I was late, really. I think, like you, you know, Loose Change, I think, was good in that it's not a perfect film, but it does ask questions. It was one of the first to ask questions. And I think that was the important thing, is to say, hey, there are some funny things going on here, and we have to look at this. It wasn't an immediate, oh, I'm woken up now. It was, you know, I'm going to keep digging, keep investigating. I've always wanted to look at both sides of the issue, never just looking at the true side and saying, yeah, you know, that's it. I look at both sides and try to figure out, you know, what's really going on. I've learned a lot through Richard Gage. I work with him on a regular basis and his team, and, you know, I just keep learning as I go, just like we all do.
One question, I have an engineer here, and, you know, I've become known for a piece of research, original 9/11 research I did called Fabled Airplanes, which is available up on my website. And I'm one of those people that they are called no-planers, because I believe there were no planes, and that instead the planes were faked within the media studio. And I know when I first saw Loose Change, I'd look at that hole in that building, and I still wonder today, are any engineers or architects looking at how would the impact of one of those airplanes on those towers really unfold? Would it really just slip inside ever so neatly without anything breaking off and then disappear from view? So I know this isn't something I don't think addressed in the conference. I think partly the architects and engineers, they have taken the most solid pieces of evidence to establish the most clear-cut case. But at the same time, there are still a lot of mysteries, and I want to just throw it over to you, Mike. Do you have any comments on the idea of the no-plane theory, or have you ever looked at that, or do you know any engineers who've actually attempted to look at that?
That's a good question, Chris. I have looked at some videos to see, you know, what it means to be a no-planer and kind of take that point of view. There's some interesting ideas there. I think that, you know, what I've done is sort of stuck with architects and engineers in that the, you know, we do have, as you said, some of the most solid evidence. And we don't look at the no-plane theory. We're not investigating currently, so I don't know anybody specifically looking at exactly the question you asked. We're not looking at how did those planes, you know, how would they penetrate the buildings? How what would the damage structure or damage pattern be? So, you know, one of the things I would say about it is it'd be interesting to see what NIST had to say in terms of their models and things, because they're supposedly, they were supposed to investigate that, and we haven't been able to look at their models and really do our own independent investigation.
Yeah, I doubt NIST even looked at it as an issue. It was interesting, the other day I was interested in the issue, so I searched the internet and I looked at the airplane crash into the Empire State Building in New York. And apparently there, the plane, after it impacted, it was supposed to be half sticking out of the tower, and there was considerable rubble below the Empire State Building. So, but I think that's an interesting question. But as, you know, I think it's unfortunate that there's such dissension in the 9/11 community, because sometimes people say, oh, no planers are disinfo agents. And in my view, people who believe the planes should know better, and they're disinfo. But we've got to be tolerant of different perspectives. And I think it's clearly the case that the A&E architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth have clearly put together the most solid criminal case. And, you know, hopefully over time, other elements of 9/11 will unfold. So thank you, Mike. Any final comments? And thank you for being here today.
Before I go, is Mike gone?
No.
Oh, okay. I just wondered, what kind of engineer is he?
I'm basically a computer engineer, so my background has to do with software and electronics and hardware development. Engineering gives you a background in physical systems and understanding, you know, the ability to look at the issues. And certainly within architects and engineers, there's lots of direct experience in terms of chemical, mechanical, all kinds of engineering disciplines. And so it's a multidisciplinary team.
Right. I heard you say that you had worked with Richard Gage, and Christopher and I heard him speak last year. He's very impressive. Were you interested in or skeptical about the official version before making contact with Richard, or was it through your work with him that you came to that?
Right. By the time that I got in touch with Richard directly and started working with the writing team at AE 9/11 Truth, I was already a petition signer. I was probably within the first 200 or 300 petition signers, because to me it was kind of a no-brainer. Like you look at the evidence and you say, they're not answering these questions, we have to investigate. As far as that goes, I don't think there's much of an issue in terms of you know, why we should investigate further. So I was already skeptical by the time that I started working with his team.
I see. And just one other question, which it sort of came up again just on the anniversary, just watching things. And I mean, I'm a disbeliever in the official story. And I after seeing Richard's presentation, I was quite convinced that this was a controlled demolition. But is there any – what makes me wonder is, like, when the buildings collapsed, why isn't it evident to people? If a building collapsed, wouldn't there be, if it wasn't a controlled demolition, wouldn't there be a tendency for them to fall over sideways, or for there be some sort of displacement rather than falling straight down? I mean, I don't know anything about the collapsing of buildings per se, but it seems kind of rather convenient that they just fell straight down. And then you have the debunkers saying, well, this wasn't like essentially a free fall, but it seems like that it was.
Yeah, you know, I think to that point, I would say there's a big question about, can asymmetrical damage cause symmetrical collapse? So just looking at, for example, the Twin Towers, you see the one of them I think it was the North Tower, the one with the antenna at the top. It tips over 22 degrees,
okay.
and yet the building goes straight down through its own footprint. So this is the question you're asking. The question is, can asymmetrical damage cause symmetrical? Damage to begin with cause a symmetrical collapse?
Yes.
And pretty clear that it can't.
Okay.
So that's one of the holes in the official story.
Great, thank you.
While we have Mike here, I'm going to ask him one other question. Are you familiar with the work of Judy Wood? And I've just almost finished reading her book, and it's a shocking book. And I know her main argument, she acknowledges that it was a controlled demolition, but she's saying that thermite couldn't have been the only aspect of that. She thinks that some other directed energy weapon was involved, and she talks also about not only did the buildings come down as though they were controlled demolition, but much of the mass of the buildings was actually, says the word dustified, like actually turned to powder, much of it, so fine, granular. Any comments on that? I think this is still a big mystery. Like, we know thermite was used because they've determined this from samples. Was there any discussion of her work at the conference, and any comment you might have on her work?
The question came up about directed energy weapons. It was answered by a couple of experts, including Richard Gage and Niels Harrit. So one thing that your listeners can do is, once we have all the videos available, is look at those answers. In general, I really don't want to say too much about Judy Wood's work because I'm not an expert in what she has to say. I have not read her book. But I would say, Architects and Engineers has put out a frequently asked question answer to the question of directed energy weapons. So again, referring your listeners to that, go to ae911truth.org and they'll find what our answer is to that. So I don't really want to comment too much more.
Yeah, that's great. Good. Thanks very much. That was Mike from Stafford, Ontario. Thanks. Did you come all the way up here to Ottawa to be part of this event today? Yeah, it was excellent. They set up a booth on Parliament Hill right up by the Peace Tower and showed the movie. And unfortunately, there wasn't a huge volume of traffic, but it was certainly a worthwhile effort. Okay, so, Jim, we've got an old friend here, Mark, who's been on with us at least twice before on our show.
Yeah,
and
I was hoping Mark would be here.
Yeah, I just heard they did a bit of a tribute, one of the organizers today, to Mark, and said that Mark, he was responsible for the Ottawa 9/11 Truth group for a considerable period of time and kept it going. And overall, it's supposed to have distributed over 12,000 videos in Ottawa. So there must be some people around who are getting some of it. Here's Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, hi, Mark. It's good to have you back.
Thank you very much. I showed up at the tail end of the speeches here. I only got to catch Tyrone's speech at the tail end. But I knew it was coming. I was set for it. Just got delayed. We did give out a lot of discs. We were active for 4 solid years, and to the day, like we did April 11th straight through 2007 to 2010, I guess it was, or maybe 11. I don't know. It was a long time. I think it was 11. But we did really well. We did quite a bit, got a lot of discs. Basically, in the end, it just got down to burnout. We'd done it long enough, I thought. The last, I'd say, 6 or 7 truth actions, we had found people were already well aware of what we were talking about. They knew who we were. There was no shock. The shock was gone, the denial. That part was gone. Great. I caught the last speech here, but with the Toronto hearings and with everything that went down, I think that's fantastic. I can't wait to see the final report as well as the videos because I missed a lot of it. I've got to sit back and watch the hearings online. And because I kind of got out of it once everything calmed down, I still read it, still follow it. But as far as the activism goes, I put that sort of on the back burner. My job switched. I'm a lot more visible to people, so I just figured just calm down, and I'd done my part. I made sure that enough. There's enough going on that stuff like this still happened. I know the Toronto hearings were organized by, well, not organized, but there was a lot of input from Derek and Lori from Kitchener 9/11 Truth. And I know Derek he wouldn't have been out on the street if he didn't hear my speech at the March in Ottawa in 2007. He said that many times. So it's trickle effect, you know.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
All in all, it's been a great time, and I'm glad I did show up even just for this.
Yeah, I had to be up here today, Jim. When I woke up in 2006, and at that time, Karen and I came up to Parliament Hill for September 11th. We thought there'd be tens of thousands of people here, and we were the only ones. We had our time, 9/11 inside job, and we were down here on the Parliament Hill beside the lady, the people who are protesting the torture of the Fei Long Gong practitioners in China.
Yeah.
And they're still there out there today again. I went down and spoke with them today again. But we've come a long way since over the last 4 years, and I think it is just building momentum and 9/11 truth movement taking different forms. And I'd rather be a truther than a pathological liar. And we have a government and media and police who are pathological liars. So I'm gladly endorse the 9/11 movement. So thank you, Mark, and thanks for what you've done, and I know we'll see him around at other events as well.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Okay, I'm going to move along here, Jim, and try to... excuse me, sir.
Sorry,
I'm not a good talker. You're not a good talker? Why did you come out today?
I just came out to show my support, like I always do.
When did you wake up to 9/11?
I'd say about 2003 or so.
What was it for you that shocked you?
It was seeing the videos and watching Building 7 was the big smoking gun for me, I guess you would say.
Yeah. It has a pretty big impact on your life once you wake up to it.
For sure. I mean, I've woken up tons of people to it. I had DVDs all the time in Montreal.
Oh, you're from Montreal?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, good.
Yeah.
So Montreal's got an active 9/11.
Oh, yeah.
Group.
Oh, sure. Yeah, we have the Love Police Montreal that we go around and everything is okay, Montreal. We belong to
them. Oh, you're in the Love Police?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's really something.
That's cool.
I love that video of where members in Montreal went to the city council and confronted them about using the Israeli security company for the Montreal subway.
Yep.
Are you familiar with that?
I was there, yes.
You were there?
Yes.
Was there any aftershock of that or any consequence?
We've never really had no consequences in Montreal, really. I've been surprised. We've never been confronted by the police once yet. We've been totally surprised. Compared to Toronto, in Toronto, I mean, all the time. I mean, we're never getting stopped right away. I mean,
yeah, the police were very good here today.
Yeah, okay.
There was no police.
Here they've always been, I found. I don't know.
Yeah, the Ottawa police have generally been really good. Yeah, it's in Toronto that they seem to want to have a more intimidation by the police.
That's it.
Yeah, that's really a shame. Well, thanks for coming out today.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to just move along here. I was going to try to find Tyrone. Tyrone! Oh, here's Tyrone. Tyrone has been very active in the Ottawa 9/11 community for how long, Tyrone?
I'd say about 4 years now, on and off again, mostly on. I've been coming out. I've been researching for longer, but after a certain point in your investigation into the 9/11 events, you can't stay home anymore. I felt the need to get active and join the fellow 9/11 truthers here in Ottawa.
And Tyrone's done a lot of videos. Where can people access your videos now? Can you give the sites out, please?
Sure. Well, you can go directly to my channel, which is youtube.com, Ottawa Fro. So Ottawa, F-R-O, Ottawa Fro, kind of goes with my hair. That's where you can check it out. I post things on my website, but it's the same videos on wearechangeottawa.com, Ottawa Truth Seekers, and Ottawa911truth.com. Three websites, all basically same thing, but... I think you need a lot of avenues for people to access the information.
Yeah, and you must be widely studied, I'm sure, in a lot more than just 9/11, just seeing the whole scheme of what's being done to us. Do you see the larger picture of 9/11?
Again, the research doesn't just stop with 9/11, and it goes on to other subjects, like you brought up today, chemtrails, the North American Union, what's going on in Europe with the bankers, how we can create our money. So, yeah, 9/11 was just a big piece of the puzzle, but it brings a lot of these other interests all together. And I do see events kind of, going more rapidly as we approach 2012. Now, I don't believe in that. People do, and I think they want to kind of stage incidents that kind of echo what's written in the Testament and the Bible, to the end days, to kind of fool people. So we're kind of seeing that with the Libya and the wars in the Middle East right now, and the bailouts and just the whole corruption across the globe.
Yeah, it's really heartbreaking. How are we coming across, Jim? Is the sound okay?
Yeah, it's good. Yeah, it sounds fine.
Yeah, great. Okay. Well, thanks, Tyrone. I keep seeing you out at every event. You've stuck with it for years, and we certainly need people who do. You know, I think, like, the truth is, at least I see among them, they have a bravery and courage that most people don't have. Like, everybody else is, like, so self-absorbed, they don't realize the importance of this for our country and the world community. And Tyrone's been one of those fearless warriors out there for years and in the spotlight. So thank you, Tyrone. Any last comment?
Well, I never understood the phrase knowledge is power before I got into this. But when you start to get down the rabbit hole and start to ingest this information, it's terribly empowering. So I'd advise all your listeners, which they probably have done this, if you haven't got off the computer already, get active. Start making linkages in your community, in your own circle of friends. Start speaking up, because again, we're getting now to the really interesting times, and I think now we kind of, the architects and engineers, all the research that really steps it up a notch, I think it's time for the activists to step it up a notch as well.
Yeah, great. Thank you, Tyrone.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care.
I'm gonna have to kidnap this fellow for a moment, if you don't mind it. We're doing a live radio interview out of California, BBS Radio, I'd just like to interview David for a few minutes on my show.
Can I answer your question after?
If you're welcome to hold on, we'll just be a few minutes. David, Jim, we had David on a year or so ago. He was in New York on 9/11. Do you remember David Long?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, great. Well, David, it was a good day today and a good effort. Maybe you'd share something with Jim and our audience about how the day went and why you're out here today. And I'll let you speak into the phone.
Yeah, okay. Jim, it was a great day. Every expectation that I had was exceeded. The people that managed the hill were very friendly from day one. I drove up in my truck with all this equipment, and they pointed the way, so we had no issues at all doing this protest today. They were very helpful. And we had truthers out from, or I should say truth activists from, well, more than I've seen in the last year. They all came together. And we've had thousands of people come by today. Now, they didn't come here for the protest. They were getting off of tour buses and all kinds of places. But there were so many people here today. So we've had a major event, major visibility. I've never seen something this big in Canada for 9/11 Truth. And
wow,
people are asking. It's been amazing. So we're going to make this an annual event. We'll be here every year.
That sounds very encouraging. That's very, very interesting that many people, as you say, they're not all there for the event, but that you be able to make contact with that many people. It's very interesting.
Well, yeah, and I mean, for truth activists, we didn't come here to talk to each other. Like, we all know. We came here to meet the public. We've done that in spades today, so it's just awesome.
Fantastic.
I was just talking to a woman here, so I'll hand the phone back to Chris, and thank you very much for the opportunity to talk about this.
Well, thanks, David.
All right, thank you.
Good. Okay.
Okay, so here, I'm just wandering around. Excuse me, sir, do you know 9/11 was an inside job?
I believe it was an inside job.
What brought you out today?
I'm just here with my girlfriend, and we've been watching it for many years, and I just believe that there's just too many unanswered questions, and I believe it should be investigated.
do you have concerns for our country, Canada, and why hasn't this been investigated properly by our own government? I mean, I think we know the answer, unfortunately. You know, he agrees. Okay, any final comments? Will you be out at another 9/11 Truth event?
Yes, I will be out. Yes, I believe in it. And the more that people are woken up, the more stronger, and hopefully we can get answers to questions that we need.
Yeah, it is empowering to get out from behind the computer sometimes. I mean, we can learn so much on there, but sometimes it's like we need to do something, talking to real people, supporting events, being present and standing up. That we need to do that, I feel, as Canadians and just as people caring about the welfare on this planet. So much has followed from 9/11. Any final comments, sir?
No, I've pretty much said it, and I just hope everybody just watches as much as they can, whether it be on the internet and get DVDs and just learn. Listen.
It's like it's useless to try to call for any violent revolution or something. That's so far from us. It's like all we can do is wake people up. What we want is the truth, and we want the government to come forward and be truthful with us. Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, Jim, I guess I'm kind of at the end of the day here, so most of the people have dissipated. Did you have any comments, sir?
Well, just that it sounds like, you know, it's interesting. It's an interesting phenomenon. The actual truth movement itself is very interesting, you know. I mean, somebody like Mark to go out every month for 4 years to make that kind of commitment is quite inspiring, you know. And yet, I think you reach a point, like he said, where, you know, things change for you, and perhaps, you know, you have to step back a little bit. But it's an amazing amount of information, and giving out DVDs to people, I think, is a really interesting way to try to convince them or to open people's eyes to, you know, alternative explanations as to what actually did happen on that date, and to question things. And the theme that seems to keep recurring is that people describe it in terms of waking up, and the, as a gentleman said, the phrase "knowledge is power." He never really understood what that meant until he got involved in this. So it's very interesting.
Yeah. It isn't. I think DVDs are excellent for people because I know sometimes you get feeling a little paranoid even on the internet watching all these things, and it's nice to just be able to pop it into a DVD player and sit back and watch it. And there's so many good documentary films, even though none of them put it together too well. I know I look back now at Loose Change, and I see so much wrong with that movie, even though at the time it was a big shock for me, and it, you know, it just led to a whole period of research and uncovering more and more. But it just gets worse and worse as you learn more. But it, as you say also, it does wear on people. It sometimes it's like, what's ever going to come of this? It's a very, we live in interesting times, I think is the Chinese expression. So, I think that's about all I'll do in terms of interviewing here people here on the spot. They're just, they've packed up here, and I think they may be marching through town, and they have an evening event at a club in Ottawa here on Bank Street, 390 Bank Street, if anyone's interested, from 10 to 2 a.m. I don't know if we have any Ottawa audience. So, how are you, Jim? Did you get your books?
Yes, I did, actually. Yes, I did. I haven't actually even looked at the slugs yet, but I was looking through your collection of writings, which is very interesting. And as we were speaking the other day, and I explained to you that I had reread the four articles that you had published in the Esoteric Quarterly, which gives a very good overview of your work and the position that you're trying to develop and the model that you're presenting. It's a very succinct introduction, and I'm very pleased that you've reproduced these in your book. as well as other material, because I think it all goes together very well. So I think, in some ways, I think this is a very good introduction to an overview of what your work's about. So it's quite exciting to see that you've been able to do that.
Yeah, this volume Jim's talking about is my new book called Zero Point Teachings. And in a way, I love it. It all focuses on kind of the zero point concept, and it has Karen's poem in there, You Are a Star, and it kind of looks at that issue. And it has that article series and then a variety of writings from my website. I'm really pleased with the book. And I was dedicated to Karen because I was with her through the whole time of the development of that book. I was really pleased to produce that. I gave copies to all of Karen's five children.
In terms of, as I said, you know, it's a good overview of your work. Specifically, I think the work that deals with the zero point teaching and the heart doctrine and the latter parts of your work, but that spans like about a 15 or 20 year period. So it's like, you know, it's a very nice, succinct and coherent presentation. I think the articles, again, just come back, as I said, I've just reread them, and in part the reason why I was rereading them was because I was trying to write about your work, and I had presented some of it, and I wanted to try to extrapolate some essential points because I couldn't get into it all in great detail, and I was trying to figure out, well, what exactly would I like to say at this point to sort of close off this first volume of a multi-volume work that I'm writing. And so it was very good to read it because it reinforced for me, it gave me a very strong impression as to what are the essential points and what I had missed so far and what I thought I needed to address, just to give the broader strokes. It's funny, like in trying to write about your work, realizing trying to reduce what's in the Heart Doctrine and God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, which is just two books. I mean, it's an immense amount of material. It's very complicated. There are so many issues that you touch on that you elaborate upon and articulate in different perspectives. A lot of it having to do with development in modern physics and how these ideas derived from esotericism relate to modern physics. That it's not easily digestible, and it's certainly not. It's not something that you can grasp all at once. So in a way, I think I'm trying to do something that I think would be valuable for anybody trying to understand your work, which is I'm trying to condense it too. But if they really want to get the gist of it, I think I would really, again, I'd highly recommend these four articles that are contained within this volume on the zero point teaching. It's very good. And I mean, some of the other things that you have at the beginning, I was starting to read last night, just the idea about the zero points and what zero points are and the zero point energy related concepts from physics
I love that succinct summary I have of Kabbalistic teachings.
Well, that was
a valuable chapter.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I think that, and I think that the Kabbalistic teachings, oddly enough, I had a discussion with a woman who is a server at the Second Cup that I go to, and she's... I believe she's from Argentina, but she studied religion, and we started talking about the Kabbalah, and I was telling her a little bit about your work, and she's interested in modern physics, so I'm going to give her a copy of the Heart Doctrine, you know, and she was quite knowledgeable. I was quite shocked, you know, how much she knew, and the Kabbalistic teaching is something I had no idea about until you started writing about. I knew very little about it, and it's kind of something that I, you know, realize it's like something that I'd like to pursue more. But it's very, very interesting, and this is something that goes back, you know, many hundreds, even thousands of years, and it's astonishing how complex how sophisticated it is as a cosmological and psychological teaching.
Yeah, it's remarkable, especially like how Kabbalist teachings, they in a way begin with the realms of nothingness, and they're called Ein Sof Hour, and it represents the nothingness, which is also the plenum, and also filled with infinite light. And you compare that to modern notions of the quantum vacuum, and you see such profound similarities. And then how in Kabbalistic teachings, they also describe the universe as originating from a point source and broken symmetries in higher dimensional space, precipitating different dimensions of being out of non-being. It's all so consistent with modern physics and modern physical descriptions of the nature of matter, which are regarded as due to broken symmetries in higher dimensional space. So it's really a beautiful model of creation physics. Yeah, I was very pleased with that chapter in there, and my writings on my letters about Madonna and Guy Ritchie in there, I put those in for entertainment.
I remember way back when the volume that I'm reading is called The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, and this is sort of what I would call it. This was, it's not my title, it's Christopher's title, which he used for many years ago to in his first book, in which he was trying to deal with questions as to the nature of God in the age of science, and the phrase came from a piece that Carl Sagan wrote in his book Broke His Brain, where he gives a Sunday sermon, a speech about science and religion, his point is that as science advances, he says it seems that there's less and less for God to do. And that is, whereas science puts forth material explanations of things, the more sophisticated these explanations become, the less and less there is for any kind of to draw on any kind of spiritual or some explanation which isn't based in that which can be verified empirically. Excuse me. And Christopher's reply to that was to say, is this in fact true? Is it true that as science advances, there's less and less for God to do? And so I think you drop that title, Chris, from your books, and I use it because I think it's actually a good title for the whole body of all of your work. I think it's a good overview of what you've been doing for the last 35 years. And I, at one point, Sagan says in his writings, and I think it's also in Broca's Brain. I'm not sure if it's in the Sunday sermon, but he says he's talking about the concept of God, and he says, you know, when you ask people if people say, well, I believe in God, and you ask them, well, what do you mean when you say you believe in God? And they say, well, you know, God. And Sagan's point, which is I think is a very, very good point, is, what do you mean when you say that you believe in God? Because people mean very different things when they say that. And he says at one point in his writings, he says that there's the God of Einstein and Spinoza, which is like they took the view that the natural laws, which scientists have discovered, which govern the universe, are what Einstein and Spinoza meant by God. And then there are other people who believe that God is some sort of bearded patriarch who sits up in heaven and oversees creation. And Sagan says, I don't know if there's any compelling evidence for bearded patriarchs overseeing creation, but it would be madness to deny the existence of natural laws. And first of all, this is kind of a standard Sagan ploy where it's an imaginary choice that he's created here, because there are obviously other ideas about God that don't fit into either one of these two polar extremes that he creates. So it's sort of a straw man when he says that, you know, it would be madness to deny natural laws. In other words, natural law is the explanation of what God could mean, but there's no evidence for a bearded patriarch. But in exploring this question of God's contracting universe, I think when you should comment on this, because I think that you have developed a very different idea, probably, of what you mean by God, and I think of the Kabbalistic teachings, and I think of this idea of these realms of nothingness. I think you've come to a very, I think your work actually although it's arguing for higher spiritual realities and for God, quote-unquote, I think that it's actually deepens in many ways the mystery of what God is. I mean, I certainly think in my own case that's the way I regard it. Is I would say that I believe in God, but it would take a long time to explain to somebody what I mean by God. And Sagan's question's a good question. What do you mean when you say that?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it follows from the secret doctrine. I like the quote in the beginning of the secret doctrine where they ask Blavatsky if she believes in God. And she kind of begins, well, she doesn't believe in the God of the Bible or a bearded patriarch. But then she says, but she does believe in builders, intelligent builders.
Yes.
And the earth is intelligently sculpted by these builders on both divine and spiritual planes. She also calls them masons, because I think that's the original concept of masons, that they helped fashion the world.
Yes.
In Kabbalah, you have different realms of angels and archangels who play a role in fashioning creation. But as you say, from our work, it leads to a very different kind of view of, what is the nature of God, the ultimate life source. And it leads to kind of an abstract, in Kabbalah, God is like Ein Sof, Ein Sof Aur. It's these realms of negative existence. You know, a very sophisticated and complex model of what is meant by the absolute or of God. And it takes the whole argument way beyond the normal conception of God as in human form. Like Gurdjieff says, people think of God, he has a comb. He says they take the phrase from the Bible, man is made in the image of God, and then he says, oh, good, they think that God, has a comb in his left pocket. We anthropomorphize God in that way, whereas in mystical teachings, really there are hierarchies of intelligences. And in a way, the processes of creation are instigated by an ultimate life source, but then the actual articulation and differentiation of elements and beings and so on are carried out by a hierarchy of intelligences on different planes of being. So it leads to really sophisticated notions about what that really means to ask that question, do you believe in God?
Yeah, and also, I'm thinking too that, that even the idea of evolution, I think that this is entirely compatible with the idea that, evolution is as we understand it, is sort of a partial explanation of something that's torn out of its higher connections to these higher dimensional intelligences and hierarchies of intelligence. And the part of the problem is that I think something that people just don't understand, it's kind of twofold, is that in modern science you have basically a flatland idea of the universe where there is no recognition of this hierarchy of intelligence within ourselves or within the universe, and there's certainly no recognition of an isomorphism between the hierarchy of intelligences that exists within us and how those relate to the hierarchies of intelligences of different planes or gradations of materiality and consciousness in the universe. And then on top of that, it's what we don't recognize is that a lower level cannot understand or explain a higher level in its own terms. That's what part of, in a way, that's another aspect of what a zero point is. When you pass through a zero point into a higher dimension, you're passing from one level to another, and everything that the terms of relation that we might use to explain things in the material world don't apply on these higher levels. In the example of David Bohm's holographic theory, he's talking about these higher dimensional realities that are adhere to holographic principles. Well, that may be true, but then he uses explanations that he draws from from our world, and he applies them. And you say that at one point in your book, and I think that's a very good caution, is that he's talking about things in the explicate order as explanatory, providing them as an explanatory framework for something in this higher dimensional order. And that's why these things are really only approximations. We can't really describe these higher dimensions. We can in a limited way, because we can extrapolate certain things like numbers and principles that seem to apply on these different levels. But we have to be very careful and remember that a lower level cannot comprehend a higher level. And I think that exists within ourselves and within the universe. And I think that's part of the great mystery, is like, what is the nature of these, like, these strange higher dimensions that exist within ourselves and within the universe? They obviously are ruled by very different dynamics and adhere to different feature different properties and are inexplicable to a certain extent, and we can only really approximate them. But you know, that's the task.
And yet it's so interesting, if you have that concept of a multidimensional universe, it gives you a framework within which you can place so many of these phenomena, like psychical phenomena, ghosts, poltergeists, reincarnation, like all of these out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, all of these phenomena which are mainly ignored within the mainstream of science. At least we can begin with this kind of higher dimensional model. We can begin to have a framework within which we might be able to understand them within a scientific framework.
Yeah,
I think
absolutely.
That's very important. Like, people, the issues, most people seem to think the issue is whether or not these phenomena exist. But we've taken the step beyond that to try to articulate a more complex scientific model of how indeed they could actually work. So I think that also really adds to this notion of God's contracting universe, is because in a way there's a lot of scientific evidence that there's more to life than meets the eye. There's more than simply material existence. There is extensive evidence for these kinds of psychical and mystical and spiritual experiences.
Yeah.
And they need to be explained. Always reminds me of that quote you used to quote from Eddington about science is, accounting for the facts of experience or something. Do you remember that?
Yeah. Yeah, it's an earnest. He defined science as an earnest attempt to put in order the facts of experience. And that's, I think that's, you know, that's a good generic description of science in its broadest meaning, and in that context, you can have a spiritual science, it allows for that. I mean, one of the other things too is that you bring up the example. These are all excellent examples of all these psychical phenomena, but then even the most basic phenomena, the phenomena of life and consciousness, are really inexplicable. I mean, we think that we try to explain these things as emergent properties from material processes, but they involve this miraculous transition where somehow matter, which is blind and inert, suddenly gains consciousness and life. And I mean, you know, there's some evidence to suggest that this can happen, and but it's very equivocal. And It certainly, the matter is not nearly as closed as most people seem to assume it is, and this provides an entirely different way of understanding these things. And I think a more compelling and convincing model to me is to say that life comes from life and that consciousness comes from consciousness, rather than being emergent phenomena, these are things that occur because life and consciousness are basically stepped down and manifest out of these higher dimensional spaces within a human being through the heart, and the life and consciousness principles are activated through these zero points in the heart, and I think that's at least at the very least, I think that's such a useful model to try to examine these big questions from, because it stands everything on its head and looks at them from an entirely different perspective, and actually makes many things that are incomprehensible in terms of our currently understanding of things much more comprehensible and much more readily subsumed by the explanatory framework. I think people have completely missed the boat in the study of consciousness, just assuming that it's produced in the head brain by the material processes, the electrochemical processes in the brain. There's not really any evidence to suggest that this occurs. There's evidence to suggest that it might occur, but there really isn't any hard evidence for this, and yet everybody assumes that this is how things happen. And the same is true of life, is that we just assume that life comes, suddenly emerges with all of these miraculous properties from matter. But when you turn it around and you think in an entirely different direction and from an entirely different set of assumptions, it's at least plausible that these things are, that this is actually the more correct version. As you say, there are so many anomalous phenomena within the current understanding of things that I think the evidence is quite actually more compelling for the mystical and esoteric perspective than there is for the modern scientific materialist reductionist approach to trying to understand things. Like it's funny because it's, from this perspective, I think you were actually going to say this. It's like, when you really look at it, it's not a question of God's contracting universe. It's like God's universe is getting larger and larger when you approach it from this perspective.
Yeah, there are more and more mysteries.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that quote from Uspensky where he says, if you could gather up all the inexplicable and inexplicable phenomena and unexplained things, it would wash away everything you think you knew. And it's like, in a way, God's universe is expanding, because as we learn more and more, it's like the universe gets more and more complicated, and down at zero point levels in modern physics, and there are new ideas about holographic physics. The universe has just gotten exponentially more complicated now of what interior realms of being you could potentially have. So, yeah, it does turn it on its head in a way. Jim, I meant to ask you, who was the woman scientist Carl Sagan married? Lynn Margulis?
Yeah.
She's in the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. She was in their new video.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's in there. I'm just saying, as a scientist, like, this is science, and she is saying on a scientific basis that, you know, this has to be looked at, and what we've been told is an obvious fraud from a scientific perspective. I was quite shocked. Just wanted to check that it was Lynn Margulis.
Margulis. Margulis. It was his first wife, I believe. She's actually... She's in the National Academy of Sciences. He's not. You know, she's a very famous biologist and highly decorated and very famous in biology. And actually, I remember doing a little research about her a few years ago, and I was quite shocked when I read that she doesn't. She's a microbiologist. She doesn't accept the explanation that HIV causes AIDS either.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. I was quite shocked when I read that. She's an absolutely brilliant, brilliant woman, and as I say, highly distinguished, highly decorated. I mean, in fact, as I say. Oddly enough, her academic credentials are actually much stronger than his, and she's been more recognized. And she actually commented on that and said that there was a certain amount of jealousy of Sagan because of he was so popular and because he was so famous that's why he was kept out, but why he wasn't recognized. But that when now that you say that, I think I may have actually read that when I was doing that research that she had said something about 9/11 too. That's interesting, though. That's a very distinguished person to be associated with that.
Yeah, it's real kudos to her that
she
took
stick her neck out too. That's always funny because, you know, it's fun. That was the introduction for me to 9/11, questioning 9/11. The truth of it is, like, I remember I read
For our audience, that is Ottawa's Peace Tower that's chiming away. Let's just hear it through. It's quite spectacular up here on Parliament Hill. It's such a beautiful spot, really. Except for these chemtrails. We just got another massive chemtrail just behind the Peace Tower from the... such good pictures of the chemtrails all over downtown Ottawa, framed against the Houses of Parliament. I'm glad our politicians are getting sprayed, too. They won't remember what they did.
Actually, it's interesting. Just an aside, I heard a doctor on who I believe was in Montreal, but she works in New York, and she's talking about Lyme disease, and there's very inadequate protocols in the treatment of Lyme disease, and a lot of people are misdiagnosed with fibromyalgia, and Lyme disease often goes incorrectly diagnosed and incorrectly treated. And she suffered from Lyme disease herself, and the way that they do treat it, that she treats it with, it's a very long process and involves strict dietary changes and high antibiotic treatment, a very, very difficult treatment, but people do get better. And one of the things she pointed out is that, and I was driving in the car, so I heard this, and I know I heard it, but it sort of went by, and then I started thinking about it. But she said that there was a study that said that if you get Lyme disease, there's some sort of spirochet that is in the body. And she said that there was some study that suggested that 25% of Alzheimer's patients have this spirochet in their system.
Wow.
Yeah, so what I didn't understand about Lyme disease was that I thought it was more like the fibromyalgia symptoms, like where you have intense, like, joint and muscular pain and no energy and lethargy and everything. That's what how I thought it manifested. But apparently, see, this is what I didn't understand. There's a huge mental component to it, an intellectual component where people can't think straightly and they have memory problems, and it really affects your ability to think and to process information, and has profound intellectual impairments can result from it. People describe it as this fog that they're in. So that's very interesting, eh?
I thought Lyme disease, is it attributed to getting bitten by a tick?
A tick or a mosquito. Mosquitoes actually carry Lyme disease too. That's another thing. Is that, yeah? Typically, it was deer ticks and it was in the Northeast, I think, in the United States mainly. But apparently now, mosquitoes in New York State have been found to be carrying it, and it's moving north. So it's in Canada too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting, though. Eh? Like, I mean, just an aside, but.
So were talking about God's contracting universe. It's funny because, see, for me, in my life story, I felt that waking up to 9/11 and all the kind of criminality of the wars and all these awful things going on in our society, I felt again, oh, this is a new chapter of the problem of God's contracting universe. Not having to do with science and God and those issues, but really with what's happening to humankind. Like, I feel that humankind, if we don't deal with these problems on the global level, you know, the future evolution of humankind is really precarious. Like, I can see, as Gurdjieff says, you know, human beings, we're at levels 1, 2, and 3, but we've got to get to that fourth level, which I see as awakening of the heart center. And if we don't have that kind of change in our planet, we're, you know, we may, as Gurdjieff says, describes, have a deviating octaves where we begin to involve or degenerate. We're, I think, at a very critical point in human history. I love the model of the chakras and how much sense it makes to see the heart chakras, the central chakra, with three below and three above, and how it said that most people are ruled by the lower three chakras, and their motives are money, sex, and power. And unless we have, it's like the yogi says, unless we have awakening of the heart, we'll be driven crazy by the monkeys of the mind. And I think that's what we need on the planet, is this awakening of humankind. And that's not just awakening and learning the truth of 9/11, because you're still not awakened spiritually then. It's really the awakening of the heart and feeling love and compassion for people around the world and for the planet and such. But I'm kind of waiting here. I'm supposed to have another fellow on as a guest. He is supposed to be here at 5 o'clock, so hopefully he'll arrive in a few minutes. I won't tell his story. I'll let him tell his story. But we may have a guest on in a little while if he shows up. I told him I'd give him a half hour to explain some of his story.
It's interesting you're on Parliament Hill, because I used to walk by. I lived in Ottawa for many years, and I used to walk by those buildings every day on my way to work. I worked in the Supreme Court building and downtown Ottawa for a few years, they're beautiful buildings. And I remember hearing Richard Gage when he spoke in Toronto with David Ray Griffin, he had been in Ottawa the night before to give a talk, and they took him up to the people who were hosting him, took him up to the Parliament buildings, and they drove around the buildings and then walked around, and he was shocked because there was nobody there, like, in terms of security challenging them or anything. It's very laid back compared to the States since 9/11 in terms of, like, you know, just the security. There's certainly more security now than there was before 9/11 in Ottawa, but it's nothing like the United States at all. Like, I mean, it's completely different.
It really is. It's really unobtrusive, and the police were really good today, and you know, I think a lot of the police really support the 9/11 truthers, because they know kind of there's something to it. They don't understand it, or it puts them in an awkward spot. But I'm not sure that the police, it's a different type of mentality than what I hear about, like, police in big cities like New York, where you know, even here when we have police, they don't have, automatic weapons drawn. You know, they're friendly, and they just, I mean, their presence is hardly visible even, really.
I remember, I know I was going to actually, before I went off a little bit there, I wanted to say that, you know, when you were asking people about awakening to 9/11, and I remember I read this book by Michael Ruppert, who used to be a Los Angeles police detective, called Crossing the Rubicon, and it was about 9/11, and it was a little bit, I didn't, you know, it was the first book I read where he's kind of challenging the official version, but the best part of the book was he included that timeline from the guy, I don't know what his name is, but there was a guy who did the timeline of the different versions that were presented as to what actually had happened in terms of the National Transportation Safety Group, or the FAA, and their version, and then the military's version, and he compared them. I think his name was Jones, but I could be wrong. Anyway, when I read that, I was really quite shocked, because I thought it immediately reminded me of the Kennedy assassination researchers, and how the original researchers just showed that the Warren Commission had completely fabricated and misstated and misrepresented and lied about things and put things that just didn't fit and to try to make them fit. I wasn't that impressed by the book, but I was really impressed by the timeline, that there were clearly contradictions in the official version, and that made me suspicious. And then I read that I read a reference that David Ray Griffin had this book called The New Pearl Harbor, and I'm thinking, David Ray Griffin? Because I had read a couple of David Ray Griffin's books. He's a theologian and a philosopher, and a very interesting guy, very, very smart and very scholarly and obviously very accomplished and recognized. And that would have been the last person I would have expected to hear had written a book about 9/11. So I read The New Pearl Harbor, and he just put it in a series of questions about the official version and said, "Is, you know, this is a question, this is a question, this is a question." He said, you know, there are different gradations of explanations. Is this, was this something that the American government allowed to happen, or did they actively take a part in it? And, you know, he said, I don't have the answers. I'm just asking these questions. And I thought that's the book that kind of set me off. And I think because somebody of his stature had written it, somebody who I really respected that it, from another field, I would think it made me more receptive to the idea that, oh, there could be an alternative explanation here to the official version. And the more I read, the more it completely reminded me of the Kennedy assassination, and I just sort of saw this is exactly the same thing on a much bigger scale. But if you can murder the President of the United States, you know, you can certainly murder 3,000 people, too.
Yeah. Yeah, and then go overseas and murder millions, and
make billions of dollars. I was thinking about that today. I was walking along thinking, how much money have these different companies who are involved in making arms and providing contractors for overseas to in Afghanistan and in Iraq, military and civilian contractors, how much money have these guys made? You know, I mean, billions.
Yeah, it's weird. It's even as a forensic psychologist, and, you know, I've worked with criminals in my life, but it's like...
Not like these guys.
And these guys, you know, the guys I worked with were just kind of normal people in a way.
Yeah.
They came from backgrounds of abuse and drug addictions and that. But otherwise, at least they had a heart. And psychopaths were very rare in the prison, eh? Really very rare. Whereas the psychopathy among our elected officials and corporate elite and in the international scene, wow, it's ridden with psychopaths. And anyway. Okay, I'm still trying to look around for this fellow. I guess I'll wait a little bit more. Quarter after. He's supposed to be here at 5:15. So, so while we're jumping around a little bit, we went off back to 9/11. We were and before that, we were talking about God and the idea of God's contracting universe. Oh, yeah, saying what a different bend or a different angle I now have on that idea of God's contracting universe.
Yeah.
Seeing it as happening in our world. That's heartbreaking a bit to me. You know how Gurdjieff says, you wake up and he talks about bearing the sorrow of our endlessness. And I find sometimes on the internet especially, it's just like everything that's happening in the world is just like so horrendous what these people go through and like Libya now and Iraq and Afghanistan, all these countries. We've been so lucky. We've been very fortunate ourselves to be in Canada. I don't think we've faced these kinds of events near, even as much as Americans have. I saw some statistics on, it's like 1.4 million American soldiers on disability now from beginning in the Gulf War, the first Gulf War. And apparently the statistics put out by the vets, I don't have them with me, but it was approximately 60,000 deaths, they said, since the Gulf War among the military and 1.4 million disabled people. And it's like the American people, you take Vietnam, 50,000 there, that was 50 to 60,000 deaths. And then you think, you know, you probably multiply fivefold all those people who have some type of disability. And it's like, what has America done to its own generation of young men and women who go out off and serve their country so much? It's all been based on deception. And I think it's like standard warfare, is all the wars are based on deception. We're never told the truth. So it's heartbreaking. I'm older now. Oh, there's the Peace Tower again. It does it on every quarter hour.
Yeah.
It's only got one this time.
Yeah.
It is heartbreaking. I guess in the Bible they say, isn't vengeance is the Lord's or something like that? That at times I do feel that, like, you know, if these people don't face retribution for what they've done through this life, in their afterlife they will. And you know, Gurdjieff has fascinating descriptions of that in The Slugs, telling what happens to husnamuses, he calls them, in afterlife states. And how they, he says they're different places, planet retribution, and I forget the name.
Yeah.
And hostages are those who lack the divine impulse of conscience, which
yeah.
is kind of the, you see, the psychopathic elite lack, is that feeling of conscience. And it's neat. I always admire the truthers I meet, because it's like, in a way, they care. You know, they're outraged in ways at what's been done in our society, and they care. They care for the restoration of justice. They care about the wars. And whereas the masses of people, it's like they're more concerned with men playing games with balls than what, you know, the fate of our nations and the fate of the planet. So often I see that kind of courage among truthers. At least the ones I've known. But anyway, at times I feel the you know, it's like Gurdjieff says, you wake up and you see the horror of it all. Mm. And that's happened to me over the past 5 years. I could never have believed how awful I see what's happening in the world. I was so asleep to it until 5 years ago. You were much more steeped in history. So I think you had a much broader cynicism about it all than I did.
Yeah.
Earlier on, you know, I'm a, yeah. But anyway, what were we coming back to? What were we talking, got off again on?
Well, I mean, again, you know, going back to this idea of like the Kabbalistic idea of the nothingness at the heart of being and these different realms of negative existence. I mean, that's another thing. As you say, that there's that great quote from Blavatsky about like not believing in the personalized God, but that, I mean, in Blavatsky, is that there's the realm of that which is beyond all definition. There's just is, which is the plenum and the void. It's beyond all categorization and conceptualization, and that's what I was sort of getting at. In part earlier when I said, you know, the lower levels can't understand the higher levels. So when we talk about God in a way, like, I mean, we can't talk about God because God is, you know, God, the absolute intelligence, whatever we want to call it. Like, when, as soon as we label it, we are distorting it. But it's beyond all categorization and conceptualization and all definitions, and it's in a way, like, it's described as being that which is entirely empty and entirely full. And I mean, that is a very profound idea as to what you mean when you say God. It's much more sophisticated than a bearded guy sitting around with a white beard in heaven counting sparrows or telling the angels that push the planets around, you know, which is kind of the characterization.
Which doesn't even make sense. Like, it's even illogical, because you couldn't, if God had, like, a human form up in heaven, well, where did the heaven come from?
Well, it's
nonsensical in a way.
But people do believe that, you know.
No.
I mean, there are people who do believe that, you know. I mean, that's legitimate, but it's like, in Sagan's work, what's and Dawkins and many of the people who these kind of radical atheists who scientists who write about how science is doing away with God, it's always like their conceptions of God are always like these fundamentalist positions that really, you know, I don't agree with that either. Like, I mean, I think that's silly, but you know, it doesn't exhaust the question. It doesn't answer the question of God's existence, and it's idiotic to pretend that it does. And that's what they do. It's like they have a fundamentalist answer to a fundamentalist reply to a fundamentalist question. Sort of it makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, it's fundamentalist science in a way.
Yeah, exactly. Fundamentalist materialism versus fundamentalist spirituality, you know, and they're both wrong. I mean, and that's another thing, too, is that I meant to mention earlier was that when we were talking about how much more sophisticated the ideas become as you study the problems of God's contracting universe from an esoteric perspective, is that you said this about your own work, is that you see it as the model that you've developed is as a model of intelligent design, but not like the fundamentalist Christian intelligent design position. But this, I think that's actually a very good description, because when you're talking about sculpting the void in Blavatsky's work, there's an entire metaphysical teaching she's articulating how the worlds are created, and it is a model of intelligent design. When we talk about the 1-3-7, and God is first one, then three, then seven, and as above, so below, and man is a microcosm of the macrocosm, and thou art that. These are all principles of the design of the universe and of the the dynamics of a completed human being who's realized their higher levels of consciousness. That these are very sophisticated teachings about things that do amount to intelligent design, but are in no way related to the what goes as intelligent design as a counter to evolution in fundamentalist Christian teachings.
Yeah, and even that dichotomy is so blatant. False in the Blavatsky framework or Gurdjieff framework, like creation versus evolution.
Yeah.
Like Gurdjieff has both, you know, because
yeah.
There's involutionary movement and an evolutionary movement, you know, and creation, when God becomes a stone, that's involution.
Yeah.
You know, you have a higher life source that takes that step down through many generations of effects and takes form in material form. But then from there, you have then the counter movement, which is like the return to the, you know, the evolutionary process to try to then evolve your higher being bodies and return to the spiritual planes or levels.
Exactly.
But it's such an artificial dichotomy, creation versus evolution. The question's worded in the wrong way from the very beginning. And I've never heard anyone in the intelligent design movement have a model of intelligent design, like an actual model. And I think the study of esotericism provides that, of Kabbalistic teachings, the Gurdjieff teaching, Blavatsky. It provides you an actual model. And doesn't mean it's true, but it, at least it's a model, and then you have to try to apply that. And as I've shown through my work, that basic concepts of the 1-3-7 has all kinds of application in studying phenomena of nature. So I hope someday that type of framework will be considered more broadly.
Yeah,
I want to forget, I'll direct people to my website at www.zeropoint.ca. And it's spelled out zeropoint.ca. And I put a special on there, people may notice, which is the complete set of all 5 of my books, all autographed and mailed for $100. And it would be a nice collection for someone who's interested in my work. I'll get a set of signed editions of all the first editions of these books. Otherwise, it would be about $150 almost, I think, the cost of the books, because most of my books are $24.95 and then extra mailing charges and such. So I do have that special on, and it's advertised on my website.
That's a good deal.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, because you buy two books and you're paying $60, and this way you get five for $100. And they're all signed, which, in a way, if I ever become known, it might be valuable.
Then you have to read them.
Yeah, that's the hard part.
That is hard. I mean, I don't want to scare people, because the books are, you can read them in pieces and you can sort of jump around but you can read them several times and learn lots of different things. But it's not something that you're going to get all at once. But they're certainly readable. I mean, I don't want to scare people off, but it's like you can't. I guess that this whole position requires a certain capacity to suspend your judgment about things and just be open and willing to try to consider these ideas. Like, you know, we're not saying that this is correct or that, you know, that this is the truth or anything, but we are saying this is a different way of looking at things. And to a certain extent, I mean, I do believe this is the truth, because if it was you or if it was me or if it was anybody else who was saying this, it would be one thing. But these ideas come from, I think, the great spiritual figures and throughout human history. And I just think that the esoteric tradition, the mystical tradition, has such extraordinary figures who have every bit as brilliant extraordinary insights into the nature of existence as the most accomplished scientists. Like, these are the Einsteins and the Heisenbergs and the great Watsons and Cricks. These are the great scientists of the spirit and the soul and the greatest psychologists who have ever lived and who have discovered these extraordinary things and have passed these ideas on, and these ideas have been examined and tested and replicated. I mean, they are science in the broader definition. They come from the spiritual science, and they meet Eddington's definition of an earnest attempt to put in order the facts of experience. And I think that's why, as I say, I do believe that this is. I mean, we don't have all the answers or all the correct interpretations of everything, but I think that there is a lot here, and it's certainly, you know, it's worth the effort to try to understand these things, because I think there's so many mistaken ideas in the literature on consciousness and much of the literature, even which acknowledges certain mystical and esoteric sources. I think there are many mistakes in the interpretations and the ideas that are put forward. And as I say, I'm not saying that this has got all the truth in it, it's got all the correct ideas and interpretations, but it's certainly a different perspective.
And you make a very important point. Like, it's not just Christopher Holmes's theories, That's not what it is. The books, what I've done, I draw from a wide range of authentic esoteric teachings, and I give them a modern interpretation in light of the issues and theories of modern science. So, you know, in terms of the heart doctrine is in, you know, Kabbalistic teachings, Judaism, Christianity, yogic Vedic teachings, the Dalai Lama, all these different sources. And I bring it together and show what it means in light of the modern investigations of consciousness and how it does provide an intelligible and meaningful kind of perspective on these issues. So it's not just my theories. More what I've done is tried to bridge that gap between mystical esoteric studies and modern science. And I've done that mainly in two areas, in terms of studies of human consciousness and the psychology of the soul, and then in terms of modern creation physics. So, yeah. So as you say, it's not just my theories, and I tend to believe these viewpoints, but, you know, I would never pretend to understand the mysteries of creation. but I think my work is beyond other material I'm familiar with. Oh, by the way, I heard an interesting interview on another internet radio show the other day with another psychologist who's written a book arguing the same point of the heart doctrine.
Oh.
Believing we've made a fundamental mistake about consciousness and that it originates out of the heart rather than the head. His name is Mark Serkis. And I've got to research him on the internet. I thought I'd try to make contact with him. Oh, here we got the peace powers again. It's on the half hour. Yeah, so that was encouraging. That was encouraging.
Sorry, what was the name again, Mark?
Mark Serkis. But I'm not sure how the circus is spelt because I started trying to research him on the internet and I wasn't really able to find yet his references to his work. But I'm gonna go back and it was on the show by Deanna Spingola, who's one of the Truth Broadcast radio shows I listen to. It was very good. Once I get my next book finished, I'm going to try to, I'm kind of tired of writing books, and I'm going to start kind of working other directions and do more to promote my book. I just hope to finish up this last book within the next 2 months, and then I need to take a break from it. But you've been working at your books for 40 years, Jim. I hope you got. I hope all of a sudden it all comes. Like for you, you know, I had six books and I'd gone. It was only 2 years ago I started getting them published in trade paperback format, and since then I've got five of them done. I'd also like to get Microcosm Macrocosm done, like part two of the Within Without series, because it's all written, but I would want to revise it and add to it further. But it was basically there, the bulk of the book. You're next, Jim. We gotta get your alien intelligence book on Gurdjieff. Get it done. I think it's really close to being done if you gave it your attention. I mean, you got so much material, you know. I mean, when you write a book, you don't write a little book. You write a tome, you know. I think how long was, and I'll know my song well, it was like about 400 or 500 pages.
Yeah, it's a big book, and it's actually a couple of books within one book. But, yeah, I'm just almost finished this first volume of The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, which is good, and as we talked about the other day, I want to go back because, I mean, I wrote a book on Gurdjieff, which is actually extrapolated for the most part out of my first book, and then I added some material about eight years ago. I completed it called An Alien Intelligence, and I wanted to just go back and revise it slightly. There's been a few books come out in the last few years that I wanted to comment on and incorporate some of the material. And it's funny because in working on The Problem of God's Contracted Universe, I was addressing some Gurdjieff material, and I got into rereading rereading some works that I'd read before on Gurdjieff and reading some new things. And so I've got some different ideas and insights, I think, that I would like to develop. But I want to get that book out there because I think there was a huge volume of Gurdjieff books that came out in the 50s and the 60s, and really since then there hasn't been all that much that's all that good in my estimation. And certainly there's books out there that, I mean, you know, you read different things that come out, and some of them are okay. And so there are definitely some good books, but I'm not that impressed by most of the material. I think your book, The Slugs, is one more interesting. Well, actually, your two books, Man's Psychological Illusions, I think is probably the most comprehensive psychological book about the fourth way. I think it's like, when I say that psychological, it's psychological and cosmological, but that's why it's the most comprehensive. It's a very good exposition of the fourth way. It's an excellent book. Anybody who wants to learn anything but the fourth way should read it. And The Slugs is the best book I've read about. There really isn't very much about Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson, which is Gurdjieff's masterpiece, and it's a very informed and interesting commentary on that book. And so I think my book has a little bit different perspective on Gurdjieff, which I haven't ever really seen, and I think answers the, well, I don't know if it answers these questions, some questions about Gurdjieff, but I think it has a perspective that is useful to consider Gurdjieff, very interesting character and his teaching. And then it's odd because you made reference to I'll Know My Song Well, which was my first book, and I just happened to be going back through some old emails and printed out something where somebody had read part of that book and had made some very interesting comments to me about it. And I've really wanted to kind of go back and rewrite it because I think, you know, I've taken parts out of it and made it into other books, but still there's a lot of material in there, and I kind of wanted to rewrite that. That was my first book and get it out there. So I hope in the next year or two to have at least two of my books out there. Like, basically, I will have An Alien Intelligence will be available in the next year or so, I would think. And then The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, if I can't sell it to a mainstream publisher, I will definitely publish it myself because I think it's an important book, and I definitely want to get it out there. So.
Yeah, I've been very disappointed with my book sales. I really am selling very few books. The books that sell best are the two Gurdjieff books.
Yeah.
And I always thought that about people who study Gurdjieff tend to be really serious. Mm. Like Gurdjieff talks about being serious.
Yeah.
And I've always felt that about people who study Gurdjieff had a certain seriousness. It's not pablum. It's not titillation. And they tend to be more intellectual, sometimes overly intellectual, but I sell most of the slugs and psychological illusions, and I think that testifies somewhat to something about Gurdjieff students, their seriousness and in pursuit of trying to understand the work.
I think that's right. And Gurdjieff's analysis of things is not easy to digest, to a certain extent I mean that intellectually, but I'm more emotionally. It's like it's not a pretty picture, and it's not easy to kind of accept what he says in a way. But I just see it as being, you know, it's basic, it's truthful, I think it's the most insightful analysis of consciousness that I've ever read from anybody. So, you know.
And analysis of the psychopathology of humankind.
Yeah.
He elaborates that as brilliantly as Gurdjieff does.
Yeah.
And in his distinction between personality and essence. Like, personality, he sees, is what you acquire through your life experiences and education and conditioning, whereas essence is what you are in your being. And he talks about how people, as society becomes more and more complex, what we see is the increasing growth of false personality at the expense of the essence and the cultivation of the essence. And I see that in terms of the problems of humanity at this time. It's like most people essentially have a delusional system about our government and what's happened about 9/11. Like, people have a delusional system, and it's been fostered through the media. And it's taken us more and more away from what we are, essence values. Gurdjieff uses that phrase in Beelzebub's Tales, which I really like, essence values. And you can see the loss of essence values in our society and in modern times. And it comes with a kind of sophistication of all the gadgets and toys and video games and movies and everything like that, the kind of growth of the artificial at the expense of what's real in people. So I think that's such an important distinction, and I like the way in the slugs, like how Gurdjieff describes Hatsnamuses, and they're people who lack the divine impulse of conscience. And that is so profoundly applicable, I think, to what's happening in our society with the kind of growth of the ascendancy of the corporate and banking elites. on the planet. It's like these people don't have conscience, like how they could do the things that are done. And it's also, in a way, also foolish and unnecessary. And I think this very brilliant description Gurdjieff has of Hotsnamas individuals, and we've got to get back to the slugs at one point, because I did want to go through his descriptions of the causes of war and his descriptions of the societies formed by the power-possessing beings and the League of Nations and things like that, his depictions of those. So if you're reading any of the slugs, maybe read that section, Jim, maybe just on the section on the human psychopathology and the causes of war. And maybe we could go through that on our next show.
Okay.
I'd wanted you to have time to go through it. Also, a new, excellent new chapter in the new version of the slugs, the degeneration of religion, which is a topic that runs through Beelzebub's tales. So I would like to get back to the tales in maybe our next show.
Yeah, that would be good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, again, you know, that's an idea too. Is that that I think you alluded to earlier to the involution and the evolutionary processes, and in combination with the idea of the octave structure of things in Gurdjieff's fourth way teaching, that those ideas combined, I mean, just the idea of involution is so contrary to the way that modern thinkers understand anything and everything, and yet in combination with the idea of the octave, it provides a perspective for understanding things in a completely different direction. It's like, for instance, the idea of a deviated octave, like Gurdjieff says that octave structures govern the unfolding of everything on every level in the universe, and that in human activity, that if we see like a process starts with an idea, and then it sounds a note, and then it goes to another note, and then it goes to a third note, but then there has to be a shock to fill the gap, and if the gap isn't filled between these notes, that the octave will deviate. And this idea of deviated octaves, I think, is so profound, because he says, like, you know, think of something like, and he talks about it in terms of religion, and he says specifically about Christianity, he says, think of how many deviations there would have to occur from the teaching of the Sermon on the Mount by Jesus to the Inquisition or to the Scholastics calculating how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. Like, what does that have to do with the Sermon on the Mount? What does the Inquisition have to do with the Sermon on the Mount? They're all called aspects of Christianity. They, like he says, in religion, you have the deviation of these octaves while still preserving the name. So you have the name Christianity applied to all these things, but they're all completely different because they're all different aspects of the octave of the development of Christianity. So it's you know, I think that's such a profound idea. Actually, I talk about that in The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, is that really one of the big problems in the whole science versus religion debate is that there's no such thing as science and there's no such thing as religion. We call very different things the same thing. We use the same term to designate very different things. Like, there's a huge difference between a materialist, fundamentalist materialist scientist and a scientist who is open to a mystic scientist, okay? Like, let's go to the other extreme. Somebody like you who calls himself a mystic scientist. I mean, they're both science, but it's a completely different perspective. And the problem in a lot of the, as I see it, in the science versus religion debate, is that a lot of the people who supposedly represent science are people who are materialist reductionists and who seem to think that makes them real scientists, but that's just a specific interpretation of science, and it's one which Alfred North Whitehead, famous philosopher, mathematician, and philosopher of science, said is essentially absurd, because it's a very restricted view and understanding of science, and it's not science at all. And that's the problem, is that there really is no science and there really is no religion. That's like, it's a huge oversimplification of
two different areas that are immensely complex, and so we reduce them to these very simplistic labels and say, well, on the one hand we have science, and on the other hand we have religion, and science says this, and religion says that. It's like, wait a minute, it's much, much more complicated than that. And that's where the esoteric mystical perspective is so useful, because it comes in and it exposes the simplistic nature of that disagreement, and also it provides, throws light on how the complexity of science and the complexity of religion, and how these things have been so grossly oversimplified, and how there is an esoteric science and there is an esoteric religion, and that's when the similarities and the congruities and the two viewpoints come together, because in essence, they're speaking different languages about reality, and they're touching on different aspects of reality in terms of the different approaches that are through science and religion, but still they're describing the same thing from different perspectives.
Yeah, and you look at the deviated octaves of religion, like, you know, it amazes me. Like, where are Christians these days? Like, how come no one protests the war? You know, why aren't Christians doing anything? You know, and what we've done, like, Western civilization, what's been done to the Muslim people of the Middle East, it's so atrocious. And like, no one in the churches speak out. And I guess in the States, they're all worried about their tax status. And, you know, and then another big movement in the churches now is this prosperity consciousness. You know, God wants you to be wealthy. You know, like, it's so insane, you know. I don't know. And then you look at the problems, you know, how many wars have been fought in the name of Christianity, and all the pedophilia in the churches and so on. All that is like the deviated octaves of religion, and then the deviated octaves of science that kind of assume this materialistic perspective, and the philosophy of materialism got confounded with the facts of science.
Yeah.
You know, the facts of science stand on their own, but they're interpreted in a materialist way, but that's not the science of the... That's not scientific. That's more the philosophy underlying them. And there's been such a confusion in that. It's like most scientists, because they're scientists, they would dismiss all the evidences for ghosts, out-of-body experiences, near-death experiences, reincarnation, all of these phenomena, which have been seriously studied by all kinds of scientists with positive results. So a real scientist, what you should do, you know, you have to weigh all the evidences and consider all the evidences. And like Eddington says, you know, you have to put in order the facts, consider all the facts of experience. And so we need a new understanding of science and a new understanding of religion. And I think in the esoteric side of religion is scientific. I mean, I believe in the esoteric teachings of the religions are ideas about the nature of creation, the psychology of the soul, how to attain God consciousness, and I think these things are a science. There is a science to it. So a lot of these false dichotomies, it's like Gurdjieff says, we approach any topic in a formatory way. And he says when we take things in a formatory way, we always see things dualistically as opposites. And what we need to find often is the kind of middle or synthesizing viewpoint. That's why, like, as you say, I refer to myself as a mystical scientist, or I run the Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science. And it's to try to bring a synthesis between those perspectives. And, it's a shame, because I see most people who have a religion, they don't understand the esoteric and scientific side of their religion. And then they end up accepting, like, ridiculous dogmas, like that the Earth was created 6,000 years ago. Like, the most absurd concepts.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So anyway, okay, it's a beautiful day here in Ottawa. I can't believe all the chemtrails. I've got some great shots today. They keep on doing it. And
moving in an opposite direction.
I'm looking away from the Houses of Parliament at the moment, but they've sprayed this all over the sky. Everything in the sky is chemtrails. All around me is chemtrails in the sky. The whole sky's clouded over with chemtrails now. But they're doing new ones, too. I'll get some more shots when we finish up in a few minutes. It's going to be a neat little video I'm going to put together. I want to learn how to do video editing and think I'm going to do a bit of work along that line after I finish my next book here. So I guess my other guest didn't arrive. It was funny because I'd met him when Karen and I came up to Parliament Hill 5 years ago, and we were up here, and he was up here protesting there at that time, and he has a shocking story to tell. Some of his work, if you want to read some of his work, go to www.illuminati-news.com/Canadian Corruption. HTM. And I guess some descriptions of his story are up on that site. And this guy's been coming to Parliament Hill, he is telling me, for 10 years now, trying to get justice over some things that happened to him. But I don't want to even begin to try to describe his story. But maybe in the future we'll have him on. So while we're winding down here, we got just under 10 minutes. It's been a long day for me out on Parliament Hill. Okay, so what do you think, Jim? Where are we? Maybe I wonder if Don is in the studio there. If he might be able to play our song there that we have on file, "Sacred Land" by Robin, and maybe we can play that and end on that note. But we've got 10 minutes otherwise. But if someone there is there, BBS, maybe they can put that song on. And we'll be back in 2 weeks.
I remember all the stories
Jim, we'll be back in 2 weeks.
Used to tell.
Okay, thanks, BBS. Thanks, Don. Doug. Success.
In this sacred land.
Talk to you later.
Buffalo did roam out on the open plain. The eagle soared high up in the sky. There wasn't any shame, there wasn't any pain. Yes, he said, they were so very proud. They lived a simple life. Mother Nature did provide. There was no law, but there was no crime. And then the white man came. He brought his way alive. Nothing's been the same. The day the white man came. Yes, they brought their whiskey and they brought their gun. They took away our land. They put us on the run. Locked us on this reservation. Changed our ways of life. Promises were made, but they were only lies. And then the white man came. He brought his way alive. Nothing's been the same. The day the white man. Some days what he said, the nations they will rise. all the cheats from long ago, they will be by your side. Into the battleground, a warrior you will ride, armed with years of wisdom, many years of pride.